Oh yeah. Welcome to the Soulcast. Today's guests is Nicole and Hugh from Ad Astra Comics. Ad Astra Comics is a radical comic book publisher based out of Canada. They seek to amplify the work of radical comic book writers, whether it's people that they publish or people that they cover on their website, mainly focusing on social justice themes. And they also do a lot of work around indigenous issues in Canada, and they work closely with tribal elders and historians to not only create like comic books that are cool works of art with good messages and shit, but also deeply researched work coming from like on a really solid theoretical grounding. I got to meet Nicole from Ad Astra Comics at the Phoenix Anti-Capitalist Conference last year, and I was just totally blown away by the approach and the thinking behind it. And it's funny, it's just taken so long to make this happen, but that's kind of how it goes with my podcast. Like, I'll be like, oh, I want to interview this person, and then it'll take like 6 months before I actually do it. But, you know, check out their work online. They're doing incredible shit. Obviously, like, crazy radical projects like this only exist when people support them. So by all means, go order some of their books. And when they're in your city, go check out what they have to say. To the long-term listeners of this podcast, if you're a subscriber through iTunes, it would be really amazing if folks could go onto the iTunes page and just review the podcast in there and give it the 5-star rating. The more reviews and ratings it gets, the more it pops up in the algorithms. Just goes without saying, but if you're feeling this podcast and you're feeling this, what I'm doing, please, you know, share it on social media, tell a friend about it. The goal of this project is to create an ever increasing platform that can be a sounding board for all kinds of radical cultural interventions. And when I first created this podcast, it was deeply with a sense of wanting to integrate like culture and radical politics together, because I see such a disconnect between art and what I consider to be legitimate politics. And that's what makes this podcast, this interview today in particular, so fucking interesting and so awesome, because, you know, until I met these folks, I didn't even know there was such a thing as radical comic book publishers. I didn't even know there were anarchist comics. That's the point, is to discover crazy shit and put other people up on it, but also just to find out about other ways to intervene. It's good to be out in the streets, it's good to be resisting and fighting back every fucking step of the way, but there are other ways to intervene as well. And that's why the work that these folks are doing is so important, because it's educating people and reaching people in a place that they might otherwise not be reached. So without further ado, I present to you Ad Astra Comics.
It's a cool story, yeah.
Okay, so who is this?
So Nicole got this book called Stuck Rubber Baby, which is by Howard Cruz. And Stuck Rubber Baby is a pun that apparently doesn't translate well into other languages, and I don't want to give the pun away because it kind of spoils the book. But it's kind of like a fictionalized memoir about Howard's time as a white closeted civil rights activist in Alabama in the 60s. And he's more famous, I think, for doing a gay comic in the 80s that ran in The Advocate, which I guess was like the big national gay newspaper back in the 80s, called Wendell. But we wrote to him after we read Stuck Rubber Baby, just like, he mentioned anarchism in it, actually, is the reason that I wrote to him. I was like, I wonder if this guy is low-key an anarchist. And he's totally not, because his husband ran for New York State Senate. But at least his husband is good and cynical about electoral politics. So we went
to be appropriately cynical after being liberal.
We went and visited them in upstate New York, and they're like both in their 70s, and they're so nice, and they're like, in spite of believing in electoral politics a little, pretty rad dudes. And they just had an incredible wealth of experience to share because they lived in New York during the ACT UP years, on top of having been involved in the civil rights movement, just like so much living history.
But the funny thing about Stuck Rubber Baby is that it's such a good example in my mind of how comics are perfect for talking about intersectional politics. Because if you have a narrative like someone's life, like Howard Cruz, he was the civil rights activist, but he was also in Alabama, and he was also a closeted, you know, and he was a gay man, and I was reading Stuck Rubber Baby when the Orlando shooting happened, and I couldn't believe what a profound callback it was to read this comic that's taking place in the early 60s, and there is a scene where there is an underground queer club that is getting broken up by the police, and there's kind of this underlying current in the comic that the most dangerous people to the queer community are the police. And that was about the 60s in a comic made in the early 80s. It's currently out of print, which is a real shame, but...
But he wants a big-time publisher to republish it, so we can't talk him into it.
Yeah.
Whoa. He got paid $40,000 to make it in the 80s, which is a lot of money.
Yeah, well, you know, that was... Everything was, I don't know, not more expensive in the 80s, but I think printing shit's become way more democratic now. He won't let y'all do it?
He won't, no, but I might keep gnawing at that. I don't know. I mean, we've had some pretty interesting luck in terms of being a very new comic book publisher. We're the only people in North America that publish comics like we publish comics. They're specifically comics around social justice themes. And I don't know. I can't speak for other people in our collective, but I like to think of the work that we do as a kind of activism. It's like a kind of political work.
Of course it is. I mean, it's so funny because I used to, like, as a musician, I was always on the other side of that, where I'd be like, oh, if you're just a musician singing about the struggle, you're full of shit. Like, unless you're out there catching tear gas, you know, you ain't doing shit, you know. And then I started, you know, a few people really confronted me on how bullshit that, like, I said it at a conference, you know, and they came up to me afterwards and be like, yo, like, if you had asked every single person in the room what got them in that room, they would list some cultural thing like music or a film or a book or something, like, and it's really easy to write stuff off, but I don't know, I think it's super, super important, and that's what I like about what y'all are doing. Like, I didn't quite realize, you know, like, your blog, you're really trying to nurture this culture of resistance through comics. And I think that's really cool. Like, well, by talking to people that maybe you're not releasing their stuff or distributing it, but you're still trying to, like, you know, generate this culture, you know?
Well, and I think that there is a community there that we don't know so much about, because it's like older people who are doing underground comics in the 70s. And it's not exactly the community that we envision, because like a lot of the people in underground comics, like, they might have some radical politics, but often, like, I don't know if you know anything about R. Crumb or people like that, but a lot of them, like, misogynistic assholes, or a lot of them are probably at least a little bit racist, whatever, but by our standards, certainly as young people, because they're baby boomers, right? So... I think that there is a community there, but it's just the alt comics community that's left over from the 70s and 80s, and it's, like, cool to be looked into, but we want to do something kind of more contemporary, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I mean, I started at Astra, the blog, in 2011. It didn't really pick up until 2012 or 2013 when I started thinking about retailing books and organizing, like, events around political comics. But, you know, when I was a teenager and I was getting interested in radical politics, I exactly as you said, you know, I was interested in cultural things that would be about politics, right? So I would listen to a lot of, like, political music and, like, read the lyrics and look things up that way, or I would always look for political art. And I guess I already just assumed that comics could be political because of the comics that I had read. You know, by the time I was 13 or 14, I was reading, you know, V for Vendetta and Transmetropolitan and Boondocks Mouse. Came out shortly after that. Oh, yeah, Mouse started it all when I was about 11 or 12. And so I always just assumed that that was, you know, that was a thing. Political comics were very much a thing. But then when I got online, it didn't seem like anybody was having any discussion about the usefulness of comics as political tools or as something that we could use in our activism. It was, you know, if you were lucky, you could find literary criticism about comics. So it started out as a blog just to be able to review comics from a perspective of, like, if I was an activist, would I benefit from using this comic somewhere in my campaigning or education work or political work? That was kind of my approach. And then it turned into, well, you know, so I started recommending comics and people were like, cool, that comic sounds great. Where can I get it? And then I was like, oh shit, nobody sells these in my city, or, you know, it's been out of print for this amount of time. So I realized it was just as important at that point to be able to show people where they could even get a copy of these comics and share them with their friends. So
that's kind of how we started out, is as a distro, just selling other people's work. And we really kind of made the leap to publishing because we were feeling like, as you may know, it's a shitty time to be a retailer, especially for something as marginal as the book trade, where it's like, we're never going to be able to afford a storefront in a place with enough foot traffic to pay for the cost of a storefront. It's like a vicious trap there.
Our readers are all over North America. It's, you know, it's difficult to just focus on a storefront model. It just wouldn't work. So, sorry, I just need to cut in here, Sol, and let you know that there is like a 300-pound Newfoundland dog in this room, and occasionally it will be crashing into things.
Oh, that's fine. I have, you know, the mailman's about to come, and you'll be able to hear my dog barking. So, they love the mailman.
Yeah, I have listened to some of your podcasts, and the last one I listened to, I think, could have just been titled Sounds of Dogs. There's a lot of dogs.
Oh, my God. Well, you know, I mean, just like speaking on like just radical projects and DIY stuff in general, you know, as I hear this story, it's, you know, you've learned the road by walking, you know?
It's, yeah.
Mm-hmm. And I think that that's like a super important element of any radical project, is that it starts off with just like, you know, pulling on a thread, and then next thing you know, you've woven a flag, a red, white, and blue star spangled.
Maybe a black flag, I guess.
Yeah. Not very creative, but well, no, it's true. And it's funny because it's a thing about prefigurative politics that came back to me. You know, I considered myself to be an anarchist in my teens and then sort of reacquainted myself with anarchism in my late 20s. But one of the things that anarchism has been talking about in modern times a lot is the prefigurative model. Like, how can you embody the change that you want to see in the world, and how can that project help to put you in a better situation to realize a larger goal? So, I mean, yeah, Ad Astra has been somewhat that situation. I guess now we're at a point where we're making the comics that we want to see in the world, which is really, really nice. It's a cool process to just be able to promote other people's work. But when you're like working on your own stuff, it's a whole other ball game. It gets pretty interesting. We're working on, I think, 2 or 3 projects right now.
That's awesome. Yeah, Nicole and Hugh, I really, when I met you, I thought that you were just a publisher. It wasn't until I did some research did I discover, like, oh, shit, like, you know, you're the one drawing a lot of these comics. And I love the aesthetic of these
comics.
Well,
I really don't have a lot that is published yet. What do I have? I have a short comic and then I have a children's book. We're going to be coming out with 2 graphic novels that I illustrated in the next year. And then we have a few web comics.
You're selling yourself totally short. Nicole is just nominated, or a book Nicole is in about labor histories, like comics about Canadian labor history, which is nominated for an award.
I forgot about that.
And then we both did a newspaper comic together about Canadian politics, which was weird because we had to write about elections, but we wrote about them from an anarchist perspective.
I can't believe they gave us the contract, frankly.
What did y'all do?
Well, we just kind of like made it look like all politicians were basically out for themselves. And
well, we talked about the uselessness of the debates. You know, there were so many issues they could have been talking about, and yet, you know, very few of them really got addressed, and none of them got addressed in a meaningful way. Yeah. So one of the comics, actually, you know what? I'll send it to you, Sol, and if you want to like post it with the podcast, it's probably the best one. But it shows the two characters looking at a lot of issues that are pretty prevalent in Canadian politics right now that just got completely ignored during the election, like the fact that most Indigenous reserves in Canada are third world living conditions.
Or, yeah, I don't know. I can't remember. I think one of them said that all politicians are kept in glass tubes underneath Parliament Hill and fed a steady stream of sound bites through a hose. Nice. And stuff like, yeah, I don't know, it's that kind of stuff. But, like, it didn't pay a ton, but it was good work. What, and Nicole also illustrated a couple of kids' books that she wasn't mentioning that are, like, put out by this Indigenous publisher in Manitoba.
Yeah.
That does, I think it kind of teaches traditional knowledge through children's books. So Nicole's been the illustrator in a couple of those projects as well.
Is that, like, Winnipeg?
Yeah, Winnipeg is one, and then there's a new one coming out about traditional plant medicines. That's like for a grade 5 reading level. So they're like not quite comics, but they're words and illustrations. You know, children's books are quite similar to comics in some ways.
I was looking through the Winnipeg thing, and I was just blown away by that. I tried to imagine myself as like in my elementary or super young, like reading about the Indigenous history, and I just think that would have fucked me up. That would have really changed my view.
Yeah.
Can you talk about that, the Winnipeg project?
Sure, yeah. The story is written by a Cree elder from Manitoba. So for anybody who's in the United States and maybe doesn't know where Manitoba is, it's kind of like in the center of Canada. It's like the Great Plains.
It's north of Minnesota and north of North Dakota.
Yeah. And so that is the traditional territory of a couple different groups of Indigenous people, but largely it's the Cree. There's a bit of Ojibwe and Sioux in the south, and there's also Dene in the north. But the Cree comprise a large portion of Manitoba, and today Manitoba is still, in many ways, an Indigenous capital of Canada. So Winnipeg was a story told by a Cree elder named Bill Ballantine. About the origin stories of the word Winnipeg and the word Red River, which is a major river that flows through the city, what is now Winnipeg, the city. And so the story is told, it's mostly in speech bubbles, so that one actually is like a comic. It's geared towards kids, but it is a comic. And the speech bubbles are in English and Cree, so you can read it and kind of follow along with the Cree, which is pretty easy to read phonetically. It's a really cool story. I spent a lot of time trying to think about what pre-contact would have looked like. The story isn't specifically pre-contact, but it's a thing where you have to think about, what kinds of accessories or clothing or hairstyles there are going to be depending on what time period you're thinking about, and you really want to kind of immerse yourself. So that involved researching local trees, that involved researching, you know, how the teepees were made, that involved looking for a lot of visual reference for a time where there is not a lot of visual reference available. So it's been a project that is, I'm super grateful that it's a consultative project where I can fire off some emails to my bosses who are all Indigenous people in Manitoba, and they can get back to me with the resources that I need. So it's been a great project to work on. I'm super proud of it.
So, yeah, but that's that's the depth that is super interesting about this stuff, is that it's not just, you're not just drawing some shit, you're researching it, when I think of comic books, I just don't think of that. I mean, maybe it's like when people think of hip hop, they just, think of somebody, whatever, but that's super interesting.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the historical accuracy is a tricky thing with comics, right? Because comics as an art form is kind of a thing where you're drawing a symbol to represent a larger thing, or you're drawing like a some would even say like a platonic ideal of a thing. So a smiley face does look like a face, but it's kind of like a symbol of a face. And that can get tricky when you're talking about sensitive subjects like historical accuracy or representations of indigenous people or any type of oppressed people, showing representations of people's struggles when there's no room for nuance that can create challenges. So the process of creating a good political comic may seem really easy, but I think that there's quite a bit of work and thought that needs to go into it.
I wonder, are there any, like, I mean, to me, it feels like some, like, Howard Zinn or Pedagogy of the Oppressed kind of shit y'all are doing. I mean, are there, like, academic sort of influences on this that mm-hmm. aren't necessarily comics?
I think for us, there's probably more popular influences than there are academic influences. I mean, we both like Howard Zinn pretty well.
Yeah.
Although I only really read People's History of the United States, which I don't know if I would even really call it academic. But I guess, I don't know what influences you, Nicole. I feel like most of my influences are on the art end.
Mm-hmm.
And then politically, it's more just that, you know, I have an undergrad in history, and history compared to a lot of other disciplines has made it out of academic jargon relatively unscathed. Like, most people writing history have to more or less talk about facts, and so that constrains their ability to write in this kind of like garbled, highly technical, elitist dialect that a lot of other disciplines rely heavily on. But like, it's still bad in history, and it's like I was reading history about time periods I knew well that I was like struggling to get through the essay often because the writing was so dense, even though the subject matter was familiar. And it's like, I came away from that with a real resentment of people who do that, and a mm-hmm. sense that the social responsibility, it is a Noam Chomsky essay, right? I haven't read it, the social responsibility of the intellectual, but I mean, the idea that just that phrase to me says it all, right? It's like, you do the social responsibility, like, what the fuck are you doing with your life if you're writing, especially because I was studying liberation struggles, right? I was like reading about the labor movement and the women's movement and this stuff, and to be reading it and being like, man, everyone should know this shit, but like, not everyone's gonna have time to like sit down and decode it. It's infuriating. And it's like, there's no reason you can't do a good job and write a thorough history using comics.
Mm-hmm.
And that goes for journalism too. And it's just, it's a lack of people trying to do it rather than a lack of interest that mm-hmm. I think is the problem. And
yeah, I actually, yeah, if I can piggyback on that, I feel like I really had a lot of respect and was influenced as a result by people who could teach me a lot about something in a really short period of time or in a really small space. So I really respected a lot of hip hop actually for that reason. I felt like I could learn a lot from reading, you know, lyrics for 3 minutes, or in artwork that would talk about political subject matter. I just felt like I could absorb so much. And, you know, likewise, I feel like Howard Zinn in some ways is like not an academic writer. He's kind of been able to write
popular
history, but in a way that's really respectable. I mean, I think I really learned to appreciate the footnote from Howard Zinn. But yeah, it really came down to who can take all of these great ideas that are locked up in a lot of coded jargon in academic circles, but the ideas are there. Who can kind of like transcribe that and make that not only accessible to a larger group of people, but like fun and engaging and inspiring? So
I want to mention our friend Sam here, who's an Australian comics artist who's won a couple of fairly prestigious awards, and he had a long-form comics essay published in The Guardian. Like, his work is a much bigger deal than ours. And he's an anarchist too, actually. But I mention him because he's very funny, because he's like, I don't care for comics at all. They're just a means to an end to me. I write comics specifically because they reach people. I don't read any comics in my spare time. I don't read superhero comics. I don't read indie comics, really. I just learn what I need to learn, and I was meant to say I steal from The Simpsons, but I don't think he's ever actually said that, but it's his biggest realistic influence for sure.
That's awesome. You know, I'm really glad to hear y'all talking all that shit on these jargon ass motherfuckers. But I guess academic wasn't really the word I was looking for. I guess I just meant like intellectual influences. Right. What would the artistic influences be, Hugo?
Tintin. It's just Hugh, by the way.
Oh, Hugh, I'm sorry.
I know, I thought you were like, Hugh, go, tell me.
Fuck my life.
I haven't sometimes. Yeah, Tintin, Asterix, and Obelix. There was a fairly obscure Canadian comic strip that ran in the 90s when there was austerity happening where I grew up, called Weltschmerz, which is a German word that means like...
the worst name for a comic.
World weariness. That was like kind of escapade-y. And then my single biggest influence in terms of political comics is hands down Doonesbury. And I know people think it's like so boring, but if you sit down and read it from 1970 on, it's like he's been on point about so many things and only occasionally wrong. And even now, it's like 2016 or 2017, he's semi-retired. He did a comic about safe spaces where he was basically like, look, safe spaces are a legitimate thing that people actually need. And it's like, that guy's like almost 70.
Right. And then he also has this litany of comics about Trump also that are making him super relevant right now.
Yeah, that's so true.
Yeah, he's been writing about Trump since the 80s.
Jesus Christ.
Yeah.
But
Let's see. Artistically for me, definitely Tintin is really influencing my style right now, and I'm A-okay with that. I guess that Alan Moore was a huge one for me, just in terms of Alan Moore has like an interesting take on just talking about how racism and sexism and other forms of systemic oppression are really relevant to a narrative, and why would you leave them out of a narrative? It's like they're so interesting. Anyways, Alan Moore is a great one. Ursula K. Le Guin and other sci-fi writers, I think, have been really important for me, too. This is a thing that maybe Americans don't quite appreciate as much as Canadians, but those late 80s and early 90s environmental cartoons. I mean, like, you could say that, like, Captain Planet is one of these, but, like, there are several more that were available in Canada that were, like, environmental-themed cartoons. And I think that those actually really inspired me from a pretty early age.
Yeah, I want to take a minute to talk about the raccoons here, which is one of the shows that Nicole is talking about that premiered, I think, in the late 70s as a Christmas special somehow, but then the guy got money to do a thing. And basically, it's about these three raccoons that live in a big kind of Oregon-style evergreen forest, is literally the name of the forest. And their enemy is this evil capitalist aardvark that wants to clear-cut the forest. And so they're always using direct action to stop him from clear-cutting the forest. And his henchmen are three pigs that wear blue.
That's awesome.
Like a kid's cartoon.
Oh, my God. But why an aardvark? What the fuck?
I think it's a weird anti-Semitic thing, actually.
No, I don't think so. I think it's... Well, the aardvark has pink skin, and I just kind of feel like it kind of just looks like a human.
Oh.
In a creepy way.
I thought nose.
Yeah, I don't know. This is how we spend our days, is talking about which cartoons of our youth are secretly anti-Semitic.
I mean, what could be better than that?
Yeah.
Well, you know, speaking of aardvarks, it's funny because right before I met you, Nicole, and first of all, your workshop at the Phoenix Anti-Capitalist Conference was my favorite. I was just so inspired by that workshop. But like literally like 2 weeks before that, I had like printed out all these old Cerebus comics because I loved the aesthetics of it. And I was going to like,
illustrations are amazing.
I was going to do some like Guy Debord situationist, like detournement of Cerebus and like, you know, turn him into some anti-capitalist thing.
That's a great idea.
You should do some feminist ones because Dave Sim is a crazy misogynist.
That's what people are saying. That's what people are saying.
But yeah. I think that happened later, though.
Doesn't matter.
I just mean, like, it doesn't have to totally ruin Cerebus story.
Oh, no, I mean, it doesn't matter that it came later. It's still fucked up. It's still worth sticking it to him on that. So, yeah.
Yeah, that's true. But if we had a nickel for every misogynist who was an amazing cartoon artist, we would have so many nickels right now. So it's just an inevitability.
Well, I'm a hip-hop artist. Luckily, I don't have to feel like any of my peers are misogynists. Rap is such a feminist art form.
Yeah, pure. I've heard the term pure used, yes.
Oh, God. You travel around. Do both of y'all do these presentations together usually?
Usually. Yeah, sometimes we fly solo, but for the last several months, we've been on a road trip and basically teaming up for everything, so...
I'm really sorry about fucking up your Denver date. I wish I wish we could have done something.
It just never would have happened, man. Like, our car broke down. Did we tell you about this?
No, what happened?
The car broke down in Utah. We had to take a Greyhound back.
Ugh.
We did get a 12-hour layover in Denver.
Yeah, Denver started feeling like a second home by the end of those 12 hours, I'll tell you what.
We were there a long time.
Yeah. But, our transmission just totally was shot, and we're stuck in a small town in southern Utah for several days.
Oh, God.
It was intense.
People were very friendly.
Were they?
Oh, yeah, Mormons, you know.
I don't think all of them were Mormons, but it was, like, a really, like, jarringly high percentage of blonde, blue-eyed people. I don't know. It was bizarre. It kind of felt like the moon, honestly. We were able to do the event in Denver didn't happen, but we had a couple of events in a couple of different places and got to hang out with some really cool people. I feel like every time we can hang out with people in a different city, we can get a sense of what kind of like activism is happening in that city. And it's really a cool thing to be able to reflect on and sort of compare and contrast. There's a lot of really interesting things happening across the United States right now in radical communities. So,
yeah, that's one thing Trump has really helped with.
Yeah. I mean, I think it's an inherent response when people remember after 8 years that they have an adversarial relationship to the state. They're like, oh my God, bad things are happening and we need to do something about it.
Yeah. And people are, I mean, and honestly, I feel like it's a period where people are actually getting radicalized.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's good. Where did y'all go on this trip? Like what were some takeaways from these workshops and community events y'all have done?
So we didn't do so many compared to last time. Like last time we were really making a thing of having events wherever we could. And this time we kind of moved through major anarchist centers without bothering to have events. Like we were just socializing.
Like it wouldn't be a formal event, but we would have like get togethers. I don't know.
Yeah. We were more interested in just kind of meeting people this time around, but we did an event in Champaign, Illinois, which there is a great, great, great anarchist scene there. Like I was surprised.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still a little bit in awe of it.
I think it also helped that it was the night before the inaugural protest. It was like an anti-fascist potluck and sign-making party, I think was what was going on there.
But they had us come and do a talk at their sign-making party, and it was seriously like, never mind us, it was billed as an anti-fascist event, and there was like 60 or 70 people there in Champaign, which is like not a big place, right? But there's a chapter of Black Rose there that is doing really great work. So that was awesome. And a lot of those young people look like they're getting really radicalized.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. There's a lot of different issues happening on the university campus there, at University of Illinois. And I think that the right kinds of activists outside of the campus community and the militancy of the students is like a really clever combination. It's great to be able to see people organizing like outside of their relative bubbles. And so Champaign has been a real inspiration to us.
This is probably a little bit of an obvious observation, but I definitely feel like for people living close to the border, like the southern border, Trump coming in has put a lot of pressure on their communities. And they don't even, they're fighting to hold ground. I don't think that they have a lot of space to push back. And like a lot of the stuff we went to seemed really high energy. And like there were folks that might not have normally come out for stuff coming out because of how bad things were. But I definitely think that they're feeling the strain.
Yeah. Especially, I mean, really everywhere, but especially like some of the resistance in Phoenix has been just amazing. Blocking ice trucks. And I mean, it's a fucking nightmare. It's unbelievable. And, you know, I mean, not to like go off on a total side tangent, but it's like, you know, everybody's freaking out about, you know, healthcare is being repealed, but it's like Obamacare fucked me. If we just had a baby, that shit was super fucked up. And it's like, where were all these people when single payer was not even on the table, when they just did this huge handout? how, I mean, so when you see that, and then you got, y'all are out there in Canada where you have, you know, your beautiful, you know, flower-eating prime minister out there, like, how are y'all thinking about what you're going to be doing over the next couple of years when you're looking at the terrain?
Well, I mean, the terrain in Canada, in some ways, it's not as different. There's an expression, America sneezes and Canada catches pneumonia, about our economic integration. So what happens in the U.S. has, like, a big, obvious impact. Like, it could totally fuck up all of Canada's shit with the stroke of a pen if, for example, Trump pulled out of NAFTA. Like, it could throw hundreds of thousands of people out of work almost overnight. And it, in a way, it's, like, same as for you guys. It's hard to predict that part of things. But it's, like, you know, we're not really interested in the social arena. There's some weird arguments going on in Canada right now. Like, in Ontario, which is the biggest province, the provincial government is trying to bring in, or it's running a guaranteed annual income pilot, which is destroying the left. Like, half of the people on the left, including us, think that even though it's probably suspect, like, nothing comes from the state without conditions, but, like, it's a net good for it to be there. But a lot of people, especially Marxists, are like, this is a trap and we should, like, openly oppose it, which is, like, it's free money for poor people. So I feel like openly opposing it is not a good look.
Yeah, no.
Yeah, that's, I mean, my last interview, the guy was really pushing universal basic income. And, you know, as an anarchist, I'm kind of like, not really like, you know, I'm not going to oppose that really, but it's like, you know, I'm not going to push for it either.
Well, the argument that the Marxist left is making is basically that they think that it's a Trojan horse for austerity, but it's like, buddy, there's austerity already. Like, this isn't, it's happening either way. It's like, either we'll have austerity and no basic income, or austerity and a basic income. But I think that secretly the reason they don't like it is because they're hella workerist in their analysis. And it's like, anything that means that people don't have to work for a living dicks with their economic model of the universe. So I think that they dislike that on principle, but they won't come out and say that. It's always this Trojan horse thing. Otherwise, for us, I mean, it's a big, big challenge that the old guy we had, Stephen Harper, the old prime minister, was, like, obviously evil, you know, and people knew he was evil. Like, I don't think he ever was all that popular, but because of the nature of the Canadian political system, he was able to, like, get in there for 9 years. But when he went out, seriously, like, he was deeply, deeply unpopular. And now it's like fucking Justin Trudeau. It's like the policies in many respects are very similar, but because it's like a handsome young guy who says he's a feminist and just isn't overtly Nixonianly evil, people are definitely demobilized. Like, for example, we got marijuana legalization coming in nationally next year. And along with legalization, there's, like, this massive, weirdly tough-on-crime component where it's, like, what, 10 years in prison
14.
For giving pot to a minor?
Yeah, if you give pot to a minor, if you're caught selling pot to a minor, you are up for 14 years in prison in Canada. So it's very much being sold as a package with tough-on-crime law and order.
Their entire thing is tough on crime. They're not even talking about revenue. They're not like, look at all the money this is going to make the government. Their whole messaging is, we're legalizing marijuana to keep children safe. I'm not exaggerating.
Yeah.
That's amazing. I love it.
Yeah, it's going to be, the next couple of years are definitely going to be interesting. The landscape is changing here, maybe as much as in the United States. Things have changed a lot in the last 10 years in Canada, in terms of, I think, especially in terms of Indigenous visibility and in terms of queer and trans, especially visibility. So that's really interesting to be able to see that taking place on social media and in the larger space of things. So and that will affect our, you know, the landscape of the publishing industry too, and art and culture. So
y'all definitely tackle a lot of those issues in your comics, huh?
We try.
I mean, we try to address basically everything. What we'd really love to do is to be able to do like 101 guides, but drawing takes a long time and writing and researching takes a fair amount of time too. So we would really need like a reliable revenue model in order to be able to do that.
It does really, at the end of the day, sometimes come down to the right people knowing how to tell their experiences as a good story. And projects like that only come along every once in a while, but I don't think anything is better than somebody accounting for their own experiences. Like a couple of months ago, we put out a re-release of Seth Tobachman's War in the Neighborhood, which I don't know if anybody listening is even familiar with it. It was first released in 1999, and it told the stories of the gentrification of New York's Lower East Side of Manhattan in the late 80s and early 90s, and the squatters movement that took place there. There were dozens of buildings that were being squatted by anarchists and radicals and homeless folks in the late 80s and early 90s. And I don't know how long I would read a nonfiction book, even if it was a comic about the history of New York City, or even the history of squatting in New York City, but having it told as a memoir with a number of different stories inside of that is an incredibly compelling read, and it's a great way to brush up on marginalized history. So those are the ideal projects that, like, I would like to be drawing and I would like to be publishing of other people's work, but you know, those only come in at a certain pace, and you have to just kind of be patient and wait for the gems.
Y'all do a lot of, or you have done some like workshops in schools also,
where
you get kids to draw comics.
We try to, yeah.
It needs to be like a whole workshop series for that to be worth doing.
Yeah, comics take a while. There are a couple of different comic style activities that you can do with people that can be a lot of fun. Making comics takes, you know, at least, a couple of hours, if not a couple of sessions. So when we do presentations, we mostly just look at other people's work and, you know, talk about some of the politics, in the books. But if I could do more like hands-on, you know, comics camps and things like that, that would be so fun to tackle different issues and put something together really quickly.
Yeah, I could see that being a cool source for ideas also.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, oh, definitely. Yeah, I think that collaborative comic making is a thing that I want to explore a little bit more. You know, Hugh and I are teamed up on two different projects right now, but we've also published anthologies that have come together that look really great and kind of have different artistic styles and different literary styles together in one book. What else? I mean, we've been talking about how one of our dreams would be to be able to put out a regular serialized comic about marginalized Canadian history. It's a thing that would be sorely needed here in Canada. And, you know, as well, whenever we go to the States, people are constantly telling us that they don't know anything about Canadian history or politics. So,
yeah, like the biggest anarchist or, you know, anti-authoritarian mobilization of the last 30, maybe even 50 years in North America happened in Canada. The Quebec student strike, and it's like most Americans barely know it's a thing, and even fewer know anything about it. So there's a gap to fill, but that's a tough one for us because of the language barrier.
Right. Yeah, French. I mean, the Quebecois has a history of the Quebecois have a history of radicalism that is, you know, something that we love to be able to learn more about, and you know, we love going to the Montreal Anarchist Book Fair, but it is a separate culture, and so it's almost in some ways like a separate country, and that brings with it translation issues. We're currently waiting to see if we can translate a comic by a Quebecois anarchist for an English readership, because it's an amazing book, but just that barrier is hard enough. These are all things that we would really like to aim towards in the medium term, I would say.
Well, another thing that, I mean, I'm not familiar with everything y'all have put out, but it seems like when I think of social commentary in comic books, I think of sci-fi, and I'm like a huge, huge, huge sci-fi nerd. But I notice, like, it seems like y'all don't really do a lot of science fiction, or do you?
It's not that we're not interested. It's just that that's a kind of long-form storytelling, right? And a big part of what shapes what we're doing is what's cheap or free to do. like, if somebody's paying us, like, Nicole got paid to illustrate Winnipeg and the other project that's coming out, and she got paid for her contribution to that anthology of labor history comics, and the two projects we're working on now, we got, like, a person's yearly income between us to work on them. So it's not that, like, we're always talking about doing a sci-fi comic about, like, asteroid miners striking in space.
Nice.
But we just need to get the money together to do it, I guess.
Have y'all ever heard of Decadence Comics?
No, go on.
They're my homies from the UK, and they do really awesome hard science fiction comics, and it's like, you know, their stuff is like tackling transhumanism critically and the Anthropocene, and it's just like really cool. I'll send y'all a link when we get off the phone, because it would be cool to link y'all up, because they're doing cool shit out there.
I love the idea, though. I mean, I really do feel like sci-fi is such a great space to be able to talk about politics. And I especially like the idea of thinking about, well, if we were, for instance, living in an anarchist society in the future, what would that look like, and what would some of the challenges be there? You know, just going full circle with the prefigurative politics thing, being able to imagine the world that we're trying to build, that's like an ultimate project for a creative person, for an artist. So it's definitely in our future, for sure. I always love finding more political sci-fi, too. So if you have any recommendations, yeah, always send them to us. That'd be great.
Yeah, I'm a total nerd. What about, is Ursula Le Guin still alive?
Yeah, she lives in Portland.
I wonder if she'd let you do The Dispossessed.
We've been talking about that.
That's really funny. I just finished The Dispossessed while we were on the road, and it's a great book. We actually were talking about that while we were on the road.
You should see if you can get a hold of her to have her on your podcast, and then you should mention in an offhand way that we're interested in doing it.
Yes, absolutely. I didn't know she was still alive. I just assume anybody I discover that's awesome has to be dead, you know?
No, she's still kicking it. There's an interview with her in a Portland newspaper just last year.
That's awesome. You were mentioning Ursula Le Guin earlier. Are her other books as good as The Dispossessed?
We haven't read them, but that's what we've heard, yeah.
There's just some short stories that I was familiar with. None of the titles are with me right now. She's also got a couple of really great kids' books as well. She's really one of those authors where I would recommend just about anything that I'd come across.
I heard really good things about The Left Hand of Darkness. I gather she has one book kind of about ecology and then another one that's more explicitly about gender, if I'm remembering right. But I haven't had a chance to check them out yet, but when I read The Dispossessed, I posted about it on Facebook and immediately got a bunch of people being like, you got to read her other stuff.
Wow. Yeah, I just finished Octavia Butler, Parable of the Seer, in that whole series. And God, I love that book. Have y'all read that?
No, I have not yet. I think it's actually on my bedstand as we speak, but haven't gotten to it yet.
Oh, yeah. I mean, again, but that's one of these books where she did so much research, and it's just so evident. I'm not going to spoil it for you. Are y'all vegan?
No, but we love vegan food.
We're shitty vegans. We are in complete political sympathy with the principles of veganism. We could mount no credible intellectual or moral defense against veganism. We just still eat animal products because we suck.
No, that's not exactly how I feel about it. We are anarchists, so we're allowed to disagree on everything except total liberation.
I guess, like, the comics I looked at from y'all used animals, and I just wondered if you could speak a little about, you know, using animals as a literary tool in your work.
Is there one in particular that you're thinking about?
Dogs?
Dogs. Okay. Yeah. Sure. I mean, where do we start with dogs? I feel like this started with your research, hey?
Some vegans were real assholes to me about that comic. They were basically like, the Inuit shouldn't have been keeping dogs in the first place.
I fucking hate vegans.
Come on. No.
As a vegan, like, that's the kind of fucking shit that just shut the fuck up. So anyway, keep going. I'm sorry.
a thing that really, where do I want to start with this? Okay, actually, I'm going to start by disagreeing with Hugh and his analysis of veganism, and to say that my primary thing about consuming animal products is, my take on it is more ecological. I look to, you know, what is causing the greatest ecological footprint, and in that way, I'm in some ways very in favor of consuming animal products that are locally produced or hunted, or anyways. To go back to dogs, one of the things about that story that spoke to me was that dogs were a part of the local indigenous population's way of life. It was like a part of their ecology, if I use that term loosely. They were the means of transportation. Dogs were practically a member of the family, and I think that there are some really incredible, if this is not too zany out there, there's a lot of credible evidence about the co-evolution of human beings and dogs, especially in hunter-gatherer societies. So there's something incredibly intimate there with, you know, the indigenous people of the Arctic and their dogs. When the RCMP, which is the Royal Canadian Mounted Police, started being involved in the settlement of white people in the north, there was this, you know, this issue that was painted as a health risk, which is that these dogs, the Inuit don't tie up their dogs. Their dogs just run free, and they accompany their owners, or they stay at home, or they run in packs, and that's just the way that Inuit communities have been. The RCMP decided that this was a health issue, and that any dogs that were not tied up or were not, you didn't know who the owner was, the RCMP officers were allowed to shoot those dogs on site. So while we were working on this project, I think we worked on it over the course of about 2 or 3 weeks, and I feel like both of us went through periods of just feeling totally emotionally devastated by this history and needing to recreate it for this comic.
I mean, I very deliberately set out to write it. Actually, there's a funny story about it that originally what I had been intending to do was there's this series of short nationalistic ads that they play on Canadian TV called Heritage Minutes that are like 1 or 2 minutes long, and they're about like the Canadian who invented penicillin or discovered penicillin or the one who invented insulin or the guy that invented basketball. I don't know if you knew a Canadian invented basketball, but this is the kind of shit that we grew up with.
Healthcare. We invented Keith Sutherland. Anyway, keep going. We brought you 24. Yeah. Okay, keep going.
I got a key for Sutherland story too, but anyway, so I found that style of ad to be really smug because they're almost always positive in the way that they're portrayed, and like even the ones that are about rough stuff end up by being like, but then everything was okay, cause like total liberal history. So I wanted to write one, and they all end the same with a still tableau shot, and it says Canada, a part of our heritage. And so I wanted the last shot to just be a dead dog and then have that frame on it to just like kind of grind it. But then it felt glib, and I felt like I couldn't be, by the time I was done writing the comic, it felt totally inappropriate to be glib about the suffering of the Inuit. But I did write it very specifically as like, I want everyone who reads this to cry. I want them to feel really bad because I feel really bad, and I don't want people to be able to, I don't know, when you're a history student, you get like blasé about atrocities because you're just reading about them all the time. It's hard not to kind of develop a little bit of a callus around it. But this got me anyway, and I wanted to make sure that it got everybody because I think, what do they call that, compassion fatigue? I wanted it to pierce people's compassion fatigue and make them feel genuinely shitty.
I think there's a real problem with, pushing that boundary of desensitization all of the time. And I think that this comic isn't quite the same. I mean, it's not, you see a lot of glorification of violence in a lot of media, and this is just kind of like, this comic is 26 panels, and it ends with a still of, it's not an action shot or anything like that, it's just like a still of a dead dog, and it's just, it looks pathetic and it looks sad and it's just like frozen. And it's, you want that feeling that has been indicated as being something that was experienced as a kind of collective trauma in the North with the Inuit. You want to be able to try to impress upon the reader that feeling. And it can be totally depressing to be working on a piece of art like that. But
how did you feel about it when you read it? How did it make you feel?
That's how it hit me. Because I love dogs. I grew up around dogs, and dogs are like this, you know, this, whatever the blinds, there are Achilles heel in America. And, you know, when we hear stories about people eating dogs in China, they get really upset. But then it's like, well, what about the way you treat a fucking squirrel or the way you treat a pig? Those animals are just as smart. But I guess that's an aside, but just like the representation, first of all, I had never heard the story. I didn't know anything about this. And so I learned about the history of these dogs and just the way it's illustrated, it really does hit you in the gut. And it just made me a little, I don't want to say sick to my stomach, but it really hit me in the gut, like in a very emotional way that comic books don't really ever do that for me. I've read a couple of graphic novels, you know, like Doctor Strange or Doctor Sleepless or whatever. Right. I forget that. And I'm reading the shit and it's like dark or whatever, but it doesn't hit me. And so I feel like the way you approach the subject matter, and I suppose that comes from the deep research of, you know, really building with people, from people who are affected by this and like talking about it, like that comes through in that story. So it's fucked up.
Yeah, I think the language of the comic is influenced a fair bit by the Kekuktani Truth Commission report, which was the sort of like the culmination of the community inquiry into the case, because it happened over a period of years, right? It happened between the 50s and 60s, and so there was a commission struck to sort of gather oral testimony from people, and that's really the, I mean, if you look at it, it's printed as a book. It's like an 800-page book of testimony and reports and survivor testimony, and that we tried to make the poster a 500-word summary of that information and the feelings of that report, which is a testament to the writer, if I've ever heard one. That probably just sounds totally sweet here, but we just like fight all the time around like visual versus literary. Like we're just constantly arguing about like, well, this should be like this. So this should be like this. So anyways, that's me. That's me being like, you know, this was done very well. I'm very proud of it.
You could probably identify with this as a rapper, even a little, just like our art is a lot more valued under capitalism, like technical illustrative skill than writing. Like any asshole thinks they can write. They're like, why speak the English language? I can write. And it's like, that's not true. What writers do is valuable, but it's like systematically devalued under capitalism because people are too stupid to know the value of writing. But
shots fired.
No, you know, but I view that as like the production of my music. Like no one would listen to my shit if I didn't have dope beats. And it's funny because I was just talking, last week I interviewed Sage Francis and I was really trying to dig into his politics. And one of the things that he said that it just really, was really interesting to me was he disagrees with this idea of like what you were talking about from that person, Sam at The Guardian. Like, I don't give a fuck about politics. About art. I only give a fuck about the politics. The art is just a medium for the politics because that's how I approach art for the most part. And I'm just constantly trying to like collaborate with people that will gloss over those, my rough edges. And Sage was saying like, you know, I disagree that the art always has to come first, you know, like if you're like, cause otherwise you're just like a fucking Christian missionary out pushing your gospel on people. And if there's no, you know, aesthetic cough syrup, aesthetic sweetener to take that down, then like, what's the fucking point? You're just another asshole. And I think that's why
Francis called you just another asshole.
I'm paraphrasing it. He's a good friend, so he can. I mean, but that's the way it is. It's like you have artistic friends, and you know we shouldn't all agree, otherwise the world would be boring. but again, I think that's what makes you know, that's what makes it work is like, you know, the sugar coating can be the aesthetics and the art of it and the experience of reading the comic book and the intention behind it can be what really makes it. So I don't think it's either or. I think both are fucking vital.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, and it's great to be able to team up with somebody who, as you said, like smooths out your rough spots. Like I would say that I am a perfectionist in some ways. And Hugh is a perfectionist in some ways, but for the most part, we are not getting in each other's way too much. I would say like I focus on, you know, well, what visual is going to be the best, way to, you know, to visualize this text and like, does it make sense to focus on something that is literally what is being depicted, or is it better to, you know, put in a double entendre? Like that's kind of my domain in some ways. And yeah, like it's a great thing to be able to be a part of a collaborative process that can, you can complement each other for sure. And comics is absolutely, it needs to be a collaborative process for most people, I would say.
We talk a lot about how you can, it's a lot more obvious when someone is a shitty artist, when they're both a writer and an artist, than when they're a shitty writer. But like, either way, if you're doing comics, you'll see online often these web comics with beautiful art, and then the writing is just a mess because it's all one person. And like panel to panel, it might not be that obvious because it's just like simple dialogue, like, hey, and then there's like a big dramatic fight scene. But like it, in the long run, it's like the, if you don't have a writer attached, or I mean, if you don't have an artist attached, then you get like XKCD, that I don't know if you've ever seen that comic, but it's kind of about science. And it's pretty successful, but they're stick figures.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. It's not that you can't have a good comic and do it totally solo, but I mean, look at the way that the pros do it. It's like there's 16 people involved in a 16-page color comic. You know, it's an assembly line process where you have honed in on a specialty and you're going to do it so well every time. I feel like comics, like indie comics is another thing, but I think political comics in general, that we've got a lot of room for... there's so much to be able to do. We've got a lot of room for improvement. And one of the ways that I think we can do great political comics is if people don't, you know, totally martyr themselves doing an entire graphic novel all on their own, and that they can find people to work with as well. They can find a community to tap into there.
Right on.
Well, yeah. It's, yeah.
Well, here's another question. So, you know, in the States, like, you know, in the last few years, I feel like identity politics and like racial awareness, people are really coming into consciousness about privilege and all these things. And, you know, with anything, like a pendulum swings, and a lot of white people are just all fucked up right now and just, you know, allied the fuck out to a point where they're afraid to stick their neck out. And I feel like one of the things that y'all have done really well and are continuing to do is not shying away from this rough history and tackling, you know, these issues. So I guess, you know, I'm thinking specifically about the books we already described, but also books you have coming out about like the tar sands and hydroelectric dams, and the way you've like, you know, A, not shied away from these things, but like, you know, intentionally worked with indigenous folks to get your story straight. So I guess if you could talk a little bit about kind of being settlers and engaging in these topics, these difficult topics, and yeah.
I want to say 18,000 things in response to what you just said.
Well, please do, because it's like super important shit. Well, you know?
I think we both do. You go ahead.
But I mean, before we say anything else, we should be pretty clear that the comic about the tar sands is not directly about the tar sands. It's a weird project because we got hired by a professor of communications who's building a database of advertising images produced about the tar sands. And so the comic itself is more about advertising on both sides, like green NGOs and also the industry, as it pertains to the tar sands, which is still like an interesting thing. But it's like, so we haven't touched in a major way on the impact that it's had on Indigenous people, which, like, P.S., that is one of the thorniest fucking issues that you could wade into, because on some communities, they're like, well, they're going to poison our land either way, so we might as well get, you know, get compensated for it. And in other communities, they're just like, hardline no, but then they do it anyway, and then they're fighting it. And so it's a very, very, very contentious
Indigenous response to the tar sands, specifically.
Yeah,
is a contentious thing. Yeah.
So it, as a settler, like, there's some conflicts you don't necessarily want to wade into. And, like, that's actually also true of the Hydro Project, which is the other one that we're working on, that there's people that just want the dams to go altogether. There's people that want a better deal out of the dams from the hydroelectric company. And then there's people that are more or less satisfied with the status quo. And I won't comment on who those people are. But in that case, we're very lucky that we're working on a big grant that was granted to a body, I think, called the Hydro Alliance, which is a combination of academics studying hydro development and then people from the communities that are, like, working to get a more equitable... I mean, the political positions of the people on the committee vary, I think. But so in that case, there was already this body for us to consult with ready-made that we just got to, like, step in, and we have an intermediary that we mostly work through. But we also got to go up to the reserves. I don't know if you want to talk about that, Nicole, or what you want to talk about. We both separately did a tour of hydro-affected communities in northern Manitoba to prepare for the comic.
Yeah, so, I mean, if somebody's going to look at a map of Manitoba, you can tell right away it is lake country. There's, like, a million lakes in Manitoba. And so when we were driving up to, and, of course, like, rivers connecting these lakes, when we were driving up from Winnipeg through the north, you know, every couple of hours you're stopping through different Indigenous reserves, towns, some larger cities, you know, 100,000 people is Thompson, or 10,000?
10,000.
Oh, gosh. Yeah, big difference. 10,000 in Thompson. And these huge hydroelectric dam mega projects. And, of course, just massive power lines that are stretching from one end of the province to the other. Yeah, I definitely think that a lot of people know what people listening to your podcast know what modern day colonialism looks like on reserves. Reserves are often not in the best of shape, and a lot of the newest buildings and architecture that you can see have been put together with money that has come from the hydroelectric dam projects. But one of the things that we want to be able to go into with this project, which is going to be about 200 pages, it's a larger graphic novel, is going to be talking about the history of that development, which started in the early 1960s, and it's still going on today. And we kind of want to show how the consultation process with the hydroelectric company and these communities was done either piss poor or in some cases was hardly even existent. And while there have been some compensation packages, when you look at the numbers, they are not nearly as high as they should be. So that is going to take, it's going to take a lot of fact checking. We've got a lot of consultation going on with it, and hopefully, fingers crossed, we'll be finishing that book late next year, I would say.
Ugh.
Yeah. It's going to be a while. We're almost, now the other project, the Tar Sands project, we are almost done with that one, and that's going to be coming out probably this summer or in the fall. And I, you know, Hugh mentioned that it's about advertising, but it's also about other things. Like, it's also about privilege in some ways. I believe privilege is brought up in the comic. It's about activism around the tar sands. It's about the precarity of having a job when you are a millennial. There's a lot of things going on in that comic that kind of weave the politics through a narrative experience that a lot of us are familiar with as 20 or 30 somethings.
I think the way that we put it is that the comic is about the choices that capitalism forces you to make between doing what is right and doing what is necessary to survive. We have to be careful with that because the guy that paid us to make the comic wants it to be a comic about advertising in the tar sands. Fair enough. But it's definitely our perspective that it's mostly a comic about how there's no ethical consumption under capitalism, I guess.
Well, that reminds me, do you want to buy some coffee, some Soulcast coffee mugs?
Next time we're in Denver, sure.
Just kidding. Sorry to cut you off. I just had to make a joke.
Do you want to buy some comics?
Yes. Sorry, keep going. I'm really sorry for interrupting you.
I want to make an effort to answer your question a little more directly, though. And I guess what I would just say, I say two things. The first is kind of like a story, which is that when we made Dogs, we just made it to be released on the internet as a picture. And then a couple people asked Nicole for a poster. And then Nicole was so excited about this that she made a crowdfunder pre-order campaign so that people could get a copy of the poster. And then right away, it went from being a favor that we were doing for an Indigenous friend who's a librarian to being a commercial undertaking that directly commodified the suffering of Indigenous people. And it was the crowdfunder was up for an hour before we were whoa, what the fuck are we doing? And we took it down. And we were we cannot do this without getting in touch with people at the Kikikani Truth Commission or the Kikikani Inuit Association and seeing how they feel about it. And the response that we got back was, yeah, go for it. We'd like some free copies. We'd like 200 free copies, which that's a big vote of confidence that because they're maybe 100,000 people in the whole of Nunavut. So to ask for hundreds of copies is a pretty big deal, you know? That's awesome. One for every family almost. But anyway, so we made a mistake. I just want to say really clearly, and I guess that is you're talking about white people being all tied up about how to be an ally. It's this might seem surprising or kind of counterintuitive advice, but you're going to fuck up. And I think that the more important thing is that it's people are paralyzed because they're often because they're fragile and they know that if they make a mistake, they will not be able to own it and climb back down. And it's overwhelmingly the feedback that I've got is that the important thing is not that you never make mistakes. It's that you do your best to be an ally. You listen beforehand. You consult beforehand. You're still going to get it wrong sometimes. And you just have to be prepared to say, I fucked up and climb down and do it differently and make up for it.
Can I just correct you there? I feel you don't mean that people are fragile. You mean that the politics of being an ally makes you feel fragile, right? You don't want to do the wrong thing.
I mean, white people are fragile.
Yeah, white people are kind of fragile.
I'm talking about white fragility.
Okay.
You know, they don't want to. White people don't want to be racist.
But right. Yes.
If you let your fear of being called racist paralyze you in the struggle against white supremacy, that's probably low key kind of racist in its impact. I guess would be how I would put that. You just have to. Sorry, I didn't mean to say paralyzed there. That's a little problematic. But if you let it keep you from taking action.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, that's been my experience for sure.
Mm-hmm. Well, and yeah, I just want to say, again, it's not that everything is squeaky clean with our process, you know? It's just you experience criticism and then you think, okay, what can I do to improve on this situation and, you know, try to make this a more consultative process or try to make the product something that everyone is happy with or that everyone feels well represented by. You know, it's not like we have a ideal example of how it is we should be doing this, you know? So we just try and learn as we go and keep a positive mindset and also just think about, particularly when we are telling other people's stories or representing other people's stories, number one, they have a right to have an opinion about what is going on in that work. It's not just my artwork or Hugh's writing, you know, it's not just our creative property. It's a shared story and we want to respect that story.
That's awesome.
Yeah.
I mean, have you been called out? Have people been what the fuck?
No,
I mean, sometimes in different ways. There was one time where I got some pretty sharp criticism about I was promoting a book that we had done by women in India about gender discrimination. And, you know, there was some issue in terms of how I as a white person would be promoting this book and as a result of which maybe taking up a little too much space in a room that was where there were other women of color there who wanted to have a discussion, you know, these are things that can come up when we are talking about these issues that are both personal and political at the same time.
Sometimes it's just a knee jerk reaction too. We put together a list of 19 comics characters that embody women's liberation, and without reading the articles,
some people just got back to us right away to be
I bet they're all white, or I bet there's no trans women, and it's
there were.
Yeah, well, look at the list. There were, and there was not just token representation. It was we'd gone out of our way to make sure that that representation was there. But it's also just like, I don't know, I'm not in love with discourse politics. It's like that stuff matters.
What do you mean by discourse politics? I'm not familiar.
People are talking about like a politics that's focused on language, like using the right words and issues of representation too, it's like that is important, but it's also in some ways the shallowest kind of struggle. And I'm saying that as a person who's like a professional communicator, right? But here's a funny example, right? You can look at the group Redneck Revolt that gets criticized a lot for the kind of image that they put forward. But then it's like in the work that they do, they send money to Black self-defense groups. Like they fundraise and send money to Black self-defense groups. And they had contact with a Black Panther who is like right before he died, one of the last things he wanted was a bag of buttons from Redneck Revolt. And it's like, that's a group that like maybe there are some issues with. It doesn't seem that way to me particularly, but like in a practical sense, I look at the work that they're doing and I see that they're doing materially useful things to be allies. And I think that you have to listen overall, but I've also read a lot lately, like in the past year maybe, I've seen a lot of people of color be like, I am done with performative allyship. And I think what they usually mean by that is it's like,
quit showing up in my meetings and saying things that you think I'm going to like and then not following through and doing anything about white supremacy in your community.
Yeah, that's exactly it.
Do y'all have a standing up for racial justice chapter out there?
No, it's not a thing in Canada. The local Asian fascist group is overrun. It's just like a Maoist front group where we are actually, which also sucks.
You have Maoists. We lost them all in Denver. They're all gone out here.
You're very lucky.
That's funny.
Yeah, we have just in the past year, there was this like fairly obscure Maoist party in Quebec that managed to expand a little into Ontario. And in the past year, it's developed like 30 chapters or something around Canada and has a really active student group. And they're very energetic organizing against MRAs and white supremacists and all this. But their politics are obviously totally fucked. And they're also, their organization is blowing up because the Quebec part has whack second wave feminist politics where they're like anti-sex work and anti-trans people. So the organization is like torn asunder by these this like political conflict right now. But anyway, yeah, that's annoying. No, we don't have a surge, at least that's mercifully, you know?
Yeah.
But the politics of racial justice are very different in Canada, right?
Yeah,
because there's a lot more, diversity of people of color in general. Like there's no one, like there's like the U.S. like about, these numbers are not exact, but like about 15% Black and about 15% Latino. I think it's like a little bit more in both cases, although it's hard to count Latino people because of the way the U.S. census works. But in Canada, it's like, I don't know what percentage people of color. Here's a question for you that we love to ask Americans, actually. What percentage of Canadians do you think are Indigenous?
Well, first of all, we're all Americans. second of all, I really don't know. 2%?
That is a pretty
good
guess.
That's a really good answer, yeah.
When we were in Phoenix last year, somebody guessed 75%. The answer is 4%. So that is, I think, like middling for a group of people of color who are overall like people from all over the world, I think, are pretty equally demographically represented in Canada. There's historic legacies of racism, but they're not the same historic legacies of racism as in the United States.
Yeah. The intensity with which there is racism against Indigenous people, and that is a thing that is kind of like sewn into the cultural fabric of Canada. That is really a primary form of racism that you can find all over Canada, no matter where you are. But then there's also a dynamic that has to do with immigration. This is an interesting thing that I found out was I was studying the Black Power movement in Canada, and I came to realize that while a lot of the influences of the Black Power movement in Canada were the same as the Black Power movement in the United States, it was a different demographic, and so the political nature of the movement was different. Whereas in the United States, you had a lot of organizing around self-defense and community defense, local community programs. In Canada, a lot of Black Power organizing congregated around university campuses, and that was because Canadian banks and industry leaders and universities were investing in sort of like neoliberal projects in the Caribbean. And a lot of those students were either from the Caribbean or were the daughters and sons of people from the Caribbean. So it had this kind of internationalism that was cooked into it. The difference is looking from the outside in, it just seems like Canada is like maybe this extension of the United States and that our politics reflect that. It's actually quite unique in a lot of ways, which is super cool. And I would super, super love to make a comic about that. I don't know if that's going to work with the Skype call.
Well, I'm just checking it out right now, and then it'll be fun.
I've spent some time. I've been to Canada a bit, and it feels very actually like a hybrid of the United States and Europe to me. But it's funny you mention, the Caribbean influence, because that's actually outside of New York and a few places on the East Coast. First thing I always do when I go to like London, Ontario or Halifax or something, I'm always just like getting Caribbean food because it is,
it's so good.
Fuck. And we don't have that. I can't find that anywhere in the States.
Yeah. Next time I see you, I'll bring you a bag of jerk seasoning. You can make your own.
That'd be amazing. And some, Calypso sauce.
Mm. All right. Done. Deal.
Awesome. The history of the British Commonwealth, right? Because it's like a lot of those Caribbean countries are in the Commonwealth, and so they had priority immigration access.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, and it's still you still pray to the Queen, right?
Yeah, she's on the money.
That's great. Good for y'all.
they'll probably get rid of her in England first.
Well, let me ask you this: Is there anything else you want to say about Ad Astra Comics and the art that y'all make that we haven't touched on?
Yeah, I mean, I just want to say that if people are listening and they are interested in doing activism, I highly recommend that they check out Political Comics and see what is out there and start thinking creatively about how comics can maybe help them with their organizing. If you do work around gentrification, look for comics about gentrification. If you do work around racism or white privilege, there are resources out there in comic form that are super engaging and fun. Just think about how comics can be a part of the creative and innovative ways that we are changing the way to make social change. There's so much out there.
Reading comics is great, but also if you're involved in the social justice struggle and you can draw, or you can write and you think you can find an artist who will draw, make comics and then tell us. Like, number one, if you're making political comics, drop us a line. Let us know what you're doing. And maybe we'd be interested in publishing your work, depending. And even if we're not, we'll definitely signal boost you, unless you're like an ANCAP or something. Best comics on the internet, weirdly, is an ANCAP comic. This guy does a Facebook comics page called Bad Memes for Bad Boys with Bad Politics. And when he's saying ANCAP stuff, it's not great, but he's a committed anti-racist and has like not at all typical ANCAP politics. And he like a lot of it is about calling out white supremacists and stuff. And it's really good.
Also, yeah, actually, I just want to attach on to that. If you are cynical about the left and you have criticisms and you feel like you don't want to get involved in the left because it's so full of bullshit, there are a few comics on the internet that you should be aware of, including the one that Hugh just mentioned, but also Great Moments in Leftism. There's several artists out there who you can tell have been involved in either like Occupy or in some communist organizing, who will, I don't know, they'll make it a little bit easier for you to go into that meeting and listen to that person blather on and on and on again.
Oh, God. Yeah, hopefully they're not all man caps.
There are some comics about that, but I'll see you afterwards.
Oh, God. It's so funny because we just announced this podcast network for like an anarchist podcast network, and all these like anarcho-capitalists keep like hitting me up like, yo, what are you going to include some market capitalism? Like, I'm sorry, you're edgy libertarians to me. Like, I'm not like, I don't know. Like, and I'm the most forgiving. Like, I wouldn't even propose that to the group because I just fucking come on. Like, fuck
right
out of here.
Yeah.
Go. Yeah, like, I'm sorry. Ron Paul lost.
It was a while ago. I definitely feel like no matter what you do, there are probably going to be whatever you're publishing online. There's going to be somebody on the sidelines telling you that you're not representing them. you know, I often feel like I can very easily respond to shit like that, just to be like, you know what, that's not my specialty. If that's your specialty, you do what you want to do, but, you know.
Form your own network. Let the market decide.
Oh, that's great. Okay, well, so y'all are, you know, y'all are hardworking, DIY as fuck. This shit doesn't get, like, a lot of your stuff is on Kickstarter. Like, you're not millionaires, like... You know, so if you are, we don't have to tell anyone.
Dude, car just broke down, and the only reason we have a vehicle right now is because our buddy in Scarborough, which is a suburb of Toronto, he owns a poster business, like a shipping poster business, and he gave us his old cargo van if we were willing to take it in and get it, like, fixed up.
So, that's awesome.
We're driving around in, like, an amazing clunker vehicle right now that only has one functioning door. But it's a cargo van, so woohoo, new company vehicle.
Yeah, paint the sides of it.
Yeah,
you know, make it advertisement.
If you have any recommendations, I'm thinking, like, a Frank Frazetta, like, woman riding a killer whale chasing a group of seals kind of thing.
Nice.
Like Conan the Barbarian, but well, not.
That's a great idea. Well, speaking of animals, just food for thought, I feel like prairie dogs are an excellent, you know, class. Y'all have prairie dogs out there, right? Or is that Saskatoon? So, you know, just keep in mind prairie dogs as you're making comic books. But what I was saying about money is if people, you know, like, your shit doesn't get made unless people support it. So for people, if people like what you have to say and they're into what, like, your approach and this awesome work y'all are doing, like, how can people support what y'all are doing?
We don't feel like anybody, like, I wouldn't personally, as somebody who is poor and, you know, doesn't have a lot of money, I would never want to expect for people to have to throw down money that they barely have on something that doesn't give them joy in their life. So, I mean, usually what we try and do is we just run pre-order campaigns. We have a book, we tell everybody how cool it is, we get excited about it, they get excited about it, and then we just ask people if they can pre-order their copy, and then 2 months later they receive it in the mail.
But if people want to buy our books when we're not doing a pre-order campaign, which is most of the time, we're distributed in the U.S. through AK Press, so probably most of your listeners already know how to get on their website and order things. If you're in Canada, we have an online store that you can order from directly. And we'll be at the Montreal Anarchist Book Fair, like every other anarchist in North America.
Oh, yeah. If anybody's listening and they're going to go to that, come say hi.
Awesome. And they can hit you up on Twitter at @AdAstraComics.
That's right.
And Facebook, Fedbook.
Same. Yep. We're on Instagram. We're on Tumblr. We occasionally share cool free comics on all of those platforms, so people can check those out, get some free comics in their feeds. Yeah, for sure.
And I usually ask, my last question is usually asking people about books, but you've talked about so many great, great books that I'm just going to skip that question unless you have something else you want to shout out.
What's the question?
Are there any books y'all recommend?
Well, we both just read The Dispossessed, which we did already cover. I just finished this incredibly long book, The First Socialist Schism, Marx and Bakunin and the First International, which is some vintage 19th century leftist drama that explains in painstaking detail how anarchism came to emerge as a separate political current in socialism. And it's very, very, very interesting. Especially if you like sectarian drama, which I do.
I'm gonna defer to Stuck Rubber Baby, which we talked about at the beginning of the interview. If anybody's looking for a grade A political comic that they can probably pick up very easily because it's available online, probably there's like a million used copies out there online. Stuck Rubber Baby is an amazing beginning point to seeing how cool political comics can be.
That's awesome. Well, hey, thank you so much for taking the time, and much respect for the awesome, groundbreaking work y'all are doing.
And, hey, Rick, I met you.
Yeah, thank you.
And I'll see you around, I guess.
Yeah, see you on the flip side. I don't know. Yeah, I don't know what's coming up for the next year for you, but we'll touch base at some point and we'll see if we can, our paths can cross.
Yeah, I would love to try to make up for fucking up your Denver date to try to get something popping here when y'all come out. So, folks,
that'd be awesome.
A bunch of my comrades were psyched about it. We just were swamped and blah, blah, blah. But let's stay in touch.
Okay.
Awesome. Well, have a wonderful day, y'all. Enjoy the weekend.
Thanks, you too. Bye.
We will shoot the family dog in the backyard, and then tell the kids we dropped it off down at the dairy farm. Screaming from the forest sounds like 50 babies being murdered in Italian horror films about baby murders. Pretty all black fisher cats sing songs of rage, 'cause the world is dark and unfair and you haven't found a mate. While you cry and sink with crows at six, I'm bored and forced to think about the cycle of life and all that bullshit. When it's quiet, I'm forced to think about myself, so I'm speaking through the silence to nobody else. Pretty black fishy cat convinced me that it will be alright, then claw my face off so I won't have to wash it tonight. Yeah, claw my face off so I won't have to wear it tonight. I've become what I've hated most too many times to count. If I can't trust myself, then I won't trust a soul. Animals biting chunks of each other's flesh all reside inside my mind before I settle down to rest. There's images of people biting my neck, slicing my chest, and simmering my meat in fried pans for breakfast. With my dick and balls and guts ground up and stuffed into a sausage wrapper, grilled to a shade of Seattle gray, surrounded by their laughter. I can't trust myself, so I won't trust a soul. If they eat me, I will hunt them forever, come back in virus form, a parasitic worm. Intestines of all of my enemies will bleed, then they'll regret the day they ever fucked with me. We were broke and fed the hamster to the dog. We were broke again and cut the dog's tail off. Made some dog tail soup with mustard packets from 7-Eleven. Oh, little Jimmy, all dogs go to heaven. No, don't cry, Jimmy, all dogs go to heaven.